Frank from London. So over to you, Frank.
Thank you. My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Hi, gang. Nice to see everybody. I think there's been a terrible, terrible mistake because it says up here this is old timers, and which it can't really include me because old timers are old, fat, and very spiritual, and I'm only two of the three of those. So I think maybe they've made an error in this, but I'm going to carry on anyway. And I'm not nearly as old as Terry, just for the record, just so you know. I just got under the wire of what you call old timers, and but I got sober when I was 8 years old, so that clears that up. Any speculation? Anyway, I am really delighted to be here. I don't really like to speak. I don't like to come out and talk. I really like to come out and listen more than anything else because I always hear something that's really interesting. The speaker that spoke before me was fantastic, the way he remembered all of the old timers. A lot of the old timers that I remember came from New York where I got sober. I moved to London when I was 6 years sober, and that was in 1985, and I did meet a few of the British old-timers who were like right out of Damon Runyon, you know, they were, if you know who that is, and really, really colorful characters and colorful names, which I really loved. Anyway, let me just start at the beginning. I'm born in Brooklyn and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and raised out on Long Island, New York, and I'm very much a New Yorker. I went to university in the Midwest and lost some of my heavy New York accent, and then I moved to England and lost a little bit more, and so I don't sound quite as toity-toit and Toid Street as I used to. But I'm a New Yorker right down to the core, and oddly enough, being here for 29 years, I also feel like I'm a Londoner, which is kind of strange when you hear me talk. But that's how it feels on the inside. Anyway, we grew up, I was born in Brooklyn. My mother was Irish English, and her Irish mother used to live with us, and my father was Italian, 100% Italian American. His parents were born, his mother was born in Sicily, and his father's father was born in Sicily, and they came over. Anyway, they met up. And my mom and dad were typical Brooklyn, New York Catholics. And in those days, you know, the deal was you would get married, you'd have a, but because they were Catholic, there was no such thing as not having a bundle full of kids. And so they did. I was one of eight kids. I was the second oldest of eight. There were two boys and six girls in the family. And I was the second oldest, but the oldest boy, so it was like being the oldest. And it was a fantastic house. I mean, it was absolutely a fantastic house. I mean, we had lots of laughs. We had lots of fun. We had lots of discipline. We had lots of crying. You know, we had lots of everything. You know, I mean, it was a very well-balanced, weird house. And to this day, when we get together, it's a laugh riot. I mean, I am the least funny person in that family. And so when I go home, I just sit back and watch everybody go. They're just hysterical. Even the kids, the grandkids are now funny. My Irish grandmother had, I think, 34 grandchildren and, you know, 21 great-grandchildren and 8 great-great-grandchildren. I mean, it was a huge, this was all about having sex and children in those families, but you never quite talked about it that way. Anyway, the reason I mention that is because when you grow up in a family like that, it was with a lot of discipline and that kind of thing, and we went to Catholic schools where there was a lot of discipline. You learn, as my friend Jim A. in New York would say, you learn very quickly that when you walk into a room as a child, you have to figure out, what am I supposed to be? Am I supposed to be a good little boy? Am I supposed to be funny? Am I supposed to be invisible? What am I supposed to be? and you size up the room very quickly. Because one false move, and who knows what's going to happen. Something terrible is going to happen. And anything that happened in the house stayed in the house. You weren't allowed to talk about anything outside. So we just thought that everybody was raised that way. And in our little neighborhood, they probably were. Everybody in our neighborhood was either Irish, Italian, or Jewish. We never saw anybody else, didn't know about anything else. I didn't even know what Protestants were until I was about 10 years old, because we didn't have any in our neighborhood. And I don't know why, but we didn't. And then, as you grow up and you feel like that, I'm just going to set the stage for this, is that the big thing there is safety. How do I stay out of trouble? How do I stay safe? How do I keep from getting in deep stuff here? And that's how you proceed. And so everything we did after that was there. And I got very, very skilled at giving people what they wanted in order to stay safe. Now that's sort of the theme for this thing. Now let's go a little further. Because of the house I lived in, I didn't dare drink too early. I might have had a beer or something when I was 12 or 13, but didn't tell anybody about it. I think I had a shot of whiskey one night and threw it down like John Wayne did, and I thought I had just burned the entire inside of my body with that thing. It was just horrible. How I ever picked up whiskey again is beyond me, because I still remember the feeling of that. I thought I was going to die. And but when I turned 18, that was it. I got drunk on my 18th birthday, and I basically stayed that way for a few more years. I loved it. I got in trouble the first night that I drank, so I made a decision right then and there. I better get good at this, because I'm going to be doing it some more. I went away to university. I went to a Jesuit college in Cleveland, Ohio. You were talking about Akron. I'll tell you about the people you meet in Cleveland when you go back for meetings there. But anyway, I got sober there. I went to college there and never even thought about being sober. Basically, I drank about 6 days a week. I couldn't really afford to drink the way I drank, so I lied about my age and I got a job in a bar, and I worked for 5 years in bars before I got married. After 5 years, I basically, got... It took me 9 years to get out of a four-year college, to give you some idea how this drinking affected me. I would get up in the morning, and by morning I mean lunchtime, and I would go and have lunch, and then I would go back to bed and take a nap, and then I would get up about 5 o'clock, I would hitchhike down to work at the bar, I'd have some hamburgers and something to drink, and then I would work until 1 o'clock in the morning. And then at 1 o'clock in the morning, we'd go drinking until God only knows when, 4 or 5 o'clock, and we'd go to after-hours joints. And that was my... Then the next day, I'd get up at noon. You may not have noticed too much academics in that day, which will explain why it took me 9 years to get a four-year degree. I remember going down, when I was about 20, 21 years old, going down to downtown Cleveland and getting dressed up and putting a tie on and going to sort of what we call an adult bar. And I sat there and I was with a girlfriend who I later married, and we were sitting there, we were making friends at the bar or something, and this guy said, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "I drink." And he laughed, says, "No, what do you really do?" I said, "No, I really drink." And, I was a student, but really what I did was I either drank or worked to get money to drink. I would go to after-hours bars. I was 20, 21 years old, and I was coming out at 5 o'clock in the morning in the worst section of Cleveland, Ohio, where they had riots and all kinds of stuff a few years earlier. And I walked out of this place like it was nothing. They would frisk us when we went into this place. It was down in some guy's basement. And I was really the only sort of out-of-the-neighborhood person that was in that place. And I thought this was normal. And I would come out in the morning, and the light was blinding, at 6 o'clock in the morning, and people were going to work. And I remember coming out and thinking, something's wrong with this. There's something not right about this. And I felt terribly dirty about it for some reason. But the next day, just I'd go back to bed, wake up at lunchtime, start it all over again, and nothing was there. So that was that part of that really heavy drinking. After 5 years of university, I realized that my life was going nowhere. I had to take drastic measures, so I decided to get married. I got married, and we had 3 children. And after about, I'm just trying to think, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years or something, I realized that the drinking was getting bad. I had been controlling my drinking at that point of the time, and this is a really important thing. I heard a guy say in a meeting, at some point, I was drinking every day, and then at some point, my disease got terminal. And by that, he meant that he started to control his drinking. And he said it was terminal because at that point, I thought that this substance, alcohol, which was kicking my ass and making my life unmanageable, I could control. And once that thought got in my brain, I had no choice. And that's how he explained it. And he said, because now I thought I was more powerful than alcohol. And that's what happened to me. So for another four, 5 or 6 years, when I was married, I was controlling. I was drinking once a week, once a month. Every fourth time I had an opportunity to drink, I would drink. Sometimes I got drunk, sometimes I didn't get drunk. But it was a misery. In between, it was a misery. I would wait for something to happen. I would explode and go out drinking or whatever it was, and then I was good to go for a couple more weeks. But I had to have that pressure cooker, had to be released. And that was the story of my drinking for a long time. And then somewhere along the line, somebody said to me, they knew that I used to drink a lot, and now I didn't drink so much, and they turned around and they said, you know, I have this fellowship that I belong to that has guidelines for living, and it just occurred to me you might, you know, be interested in that. And I thought, well, that's really good for you because you are a jerk, and I think that that would be great. But he mentioned the word Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, I may need these guys one day. And so I went along out of curiosity. And sure enough, it was people like this, people like that are in this room here, different ages, different sizes, different shapes. We went after work. We went to a local place on, we went up to 90th Street between Madison and 5th, a group called the Lenox Hill Group in New York. We went to the Jackson Hole, which was a hamburger joint beforehand. Then we walked around the corner. We walked into this meeting. And I was amazed. Everybody looked great. Their eyes were clear. They looked fantastic. And, you know, that's where, I'm sure you've heard this expression. Maybe somebody has already used it here, but there's a secret to becoming an old-timer I learned there. And the secret was, you don't drink and you don't die. And that's how they do it in New York. And that's how they get there. Now, when I came in 1979, being an old-timer meant you were 25 years around. And so there was a Bill W. dinner in November, and there still is, and the old-timers speak, you were always 25 years. I think they moved it to 30 years, and I'm sure now that I'm, you know, over 30 years, they've moved it to 70 years, and so I'll never be able to be there. But these old-timers that they had there were pretty amazing. I walked in, and there was a little old lady there. It was all decked out in a black outfit, and she had white pearls, strings of white pearls that were there, and she greeted everybody. She looked like Queen Elizabeth, this woman. It was just unbelievable. And I walked in not really wanting to be there and knowing that I was different than everybody else there. And I looked around the room, but I saw her, and this woman came up to me, and she gave me this huge handshake and this huge greeting, and somehow or other, it felt good. And she had somebody that she was sponsored, who was a little Irish lady by the name of Mary, and Mary was Irish, but she lived in New York as a companion for somebody or something. You know, she was about 6 years sober at the time, and she walked up and she, you know, she said, well, we're not having tea now. She said, but let me get you a cup of water. And then we sat down, and when the meeting was over and it was time to go, Mary looked at me and she said, I'm going to look for you next week. And I thought, oh, shit, I got to go back next week. Because Mary's going to be looking for me. And
afterwards, we went downstairs, and there was coffee, and I didn't want to be there at all. I really didn't want to be there. A couple of days later, I had my last social bottle of booze. I went all through dinner. This is really embarrassing. I'm going to deny this if anybody ever asks me this. I went to dinner with my buddy Tom's house and my fishing buddy, and I didn't drink all the way through. And at the end, he said, "How about a little amaretto?" And of course, amaretto isn't like drinking. So I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll have one of those." So I had one of those. Well, Tom and I finished two bottles of amaretto. This is like, you know, this stuff tastes like Tootsie Roll Pops. It tastes like, you know, like little lollipops, you know. It is the most disgusting last drink you could ever imagine. I am ashamed. I was a gin or a Jack Daniels drinker, which I'm very proud of. It's a very masculine thing. And then I had this wimpy amaretto way out. I'm mortified. Please don't ever mention it to me again. And then I went to another meeting. My first meeting was on a Thursday. Now I went to another meeting on a Monday. And I can remember when I started to have that last drink and I said, "Oh shit, I didn't sign anything. There's no real contract. What's the difference, you know?" So I went back there and I went to this meeting, and sure enough, there was Mary. She says, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here. I'm glad you came early. I want you to meet some people." And they, you know, the sign up here says something about the message from old timers. Here was the message we got from these people. I mean, there's a real secret to getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't tell anybody, because I was sworn to secrecy, but I think I can trust you. The secret is, I don't drink and I go to meetings. And these people that were there, some of these people were sober a long time. There was Seal and Mansfield, who were at the New York, who was Lenox Hill. And they used to wheel Seal and Mansfield out for special occasions. And I think Mansfield was about 140 years old at the time, and I think his wife was 110. And, or at least they looked like that for me, when I was about 28 at the time. And Seal came in because he had a horrible drinking problem, Mansfield came in because he had a horrible drinking problem, and Seal came in because she heard that there were pretty women at the meeting and she didn't trust him to go alone. So from then on, now these two were over 30 years sober in 1979, so I can't remember if they were 30 years or 33 years, but to me that was like all the time in the world. You know, to me, when I came in, if a guy had 6 months or a year, that was a long time. For Seal and Mansfield, they might just as well have been a TV movie for all I know. So weren't real, but the stories were fantastic. And they all had these fantastic stories. Mansfield used to talk about, they lived way up on Riverside Drive, and he used to talk about, he was a lawyer, and he had a, you know, fistful of kids at home, and he was trying to save money. So he would walk from like 114th Street, he'd walk all the way down to 32nd Street, to this little area down in Hell's Kitchen where they would make homemade booze, and he would buy a gallon jug of homemade wine, and he would pay 89 cents for that. And he would buy that because in his neighborhood, the cheapest he could get it was for $1.20. So he would save like 31 cents there. And then he would walk because the buses and the subways were 5 cents each. So he would save 10 cents there. So that was like 41 cents. Then he would come back and he would sit up on his balcony and he would just drink for the rest of the afternoon. And this one particular day, he's looking over the river and he sees Palisades over there. And there's one of these blimps, one of these big Zeppelins going by. And so he goes downstairs. He brings all the kids, gets them downstairs, he gets in a taxi, in a yellow taxi, he says, "Take me over there, I want to go where that thing is landing." So they go all the way over the George Washington Bridge in the taxi, they find where the blimp is going, they wait there, he loads the whole family up, they all go up in the blimp, he pays the guy to take them all the way over the George Washington Bridge, they circle his building, and they go back, land the thing, he gets in the taxi, comes back to Riverside Drive, and they just had a fantastic outing. And he said, "You have no idea how an excursion like that can go through a 41 cent savings on a bottle of wine," he said. And the thing about it is that it was so amazing was here I was brand new to AA. I didn't know why I was there, and suddenly I was beginning to see the insanity of that thinking, the idea. It made so much sense to save 41 cents on a gallon of homemade hooch, you know, but then he was spending God only knows how much on all the rest of the stuff. And, you know, who here hasn't had a similar experience? I mean, how many times did I save a nickel here and then throw away 20 bucks doing something else? You know, it's just incredible. When I was drinking, it was the early days of, you could take, you know, of ATMs. In those days, those boxes in the wall were not very old. And it was kind of a new thing. So I would get drunk, I'd run out of money, and I would go to the box and I'd take 20 quid out. Well, I got to tell you something, I wasn't making a lot of money. I was bouncing checks within a day. You know, I was always spending more money. This was the unmanageability. And then I would have to use credit cards and I have to do this, and I was always in debt. And you know, for me to be $3,000 or $4,000 in debt in 1973 or 4 or 5, that was a lot of money. You know, that was a lot of money, and I wasn't making a lot of money. I was very, very unmanageable. And I had these three kids at home and a wife, and I'm trying to hold the thing together, and I'm having a nervous breakdown, and I'm not drinking every day. You know, that was horrible. And then when things really weren't going bad, we moved back to New York. We moved out of Cleveland, moved back to New York. I got a job there, and as I say, a couple of years later, I got into AA. The next thing that happened is that these people had beginners meetings, and they were fantastic for me, because in those days you go to a beginners meeting for an hour and then you go to the regular meeting afterwards. They had like multi-meeting groups there. They kind of pretend to do that here, but they don't really do that. Lenox Hill would have two meetings on a Monday and three meetings on a Thursday, and it was all the same group. And you'd go to the beginners meeting and then you'd go to the speaker meeting. And then on Thursday you would go to the step meeting on a Thursday night, and there would be a discussion meeting downstairs or something. And so that's how it was. They were so smart, these people, because they got me in that beginners meeting, and it was only for newcomers. If you were over a year, you basically didn't get to talk. They would call on you, so they might call on a couple of individuals who'd been around for a while, but mostly this was focused on the newcomers, and that's what it was about. There was no such thing as 70 people in a room and half, you know, and only one third of them are under a year sober. That didn't happen in those days, and it was fantastic because all you heard was people talking about the same thing I was going through. You know, it was really, really good because I felt like I belonged. If I was around Seal and Mansfield, what the hell do they know about my life or what I'm going through, you know? And the other thing that happened is they were very tolerant. I went to a meeting in Pelham, New York one time, and I just didn't want to be there, and I drove. It was far away from my house, and I drove all the way over there. Don't ask me why, I don't know, but I walked in, and it turned out that only men were in the room, which was very unusual, but just coincidentally they were there. And I was in a crappy mood. And now they want to go around the room and let everybody talk. Well, I don't want to talk, okay? So I'm like the fourth guy in the queue, and they get to me, and I said, look, I don't want to be here. I don't like anybody here. I don't like what you had to say. I don't like anything here. I'm just here, and I don't want to be here. Well, they were so kind to me. I mean, there I was being a 14-carat jerk, and they just smiled and they nodded, and I thought, you know, you patronizing, blah, blah. But you know, they were so kind to me, and they didn't make a big deal of it. You know, they just went on and they shared, but so much of that meeting meant something to me. The idea that I was expecting to get in a fight, and nobody gave that any oxygen whatsoever. They gave me no oxygen. They just reached out, and they were so kind to me, I can't tell you. And, you know, I talked about being safe, you know, when I was drinking, you know, before I was drinking, when you grow up,
doing that. Well, the thing is that that's a big theme for me, because now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, they've got steps, they've got traditions, they've got all kinds of things going on, and I'm getting into the flow of this thing, and suddenly I'm realizing there's another way to be. And they have this concept of a higher power here, which suited me right down to the ground, because I didn't know what I thought about my religious upbringing, I don't know what I thought about anything, but somehow or other, the idea that good orderly direction, AA is a higher power, you know, just act as if there's a God, whatever it was that I got into, that worked for me. It really worked well. Nobody shoved anything down my throat, and it was fantastic. And very slowly, I got to grips with this whole fear thing. And I by slowly, I mean it took decades for me to sort of resolve a lot of this stuff. I have a very smart, very wise friend who works in the media, and she was training some people who were nervous about talking in public and whatever. And this guy was very, very frightened to go up and speak in front of 1,000 people. And she said to him, say, look, that's a good thing. You know, you're frightened of feeling like that, but that's actually a good thing. She said, that's something that's part of you. It's part of all of us. The fact is that we come from a species that had to fight woolly mammoths. And those who weren't afraid of the woolly mammoths, they have no descendants. You know, they have absolutely no, you know, the Fred Flintstone that was not afraid of a woolly mammoth, he has no little Flintstones. There's none around here anyway. You know, didn't happen. The Joneses in Wales, they were scared to death. And there's thousands of Joneses, you know. They were the most frightened of woolly mammoths, and there's tons of them around. And so in that sense, it's kind of good. And we were talking about this before. I was walking down right near Hines Street. Somebody was talking about Hines Street earlier. I was walking down by Hines Street the other day, and I ran into this guy, really nice-looking young guy, looked very so, and I realized I knew him from the rooms, but I hadn't seen him before. So I stopped, and I said, Lord, it turns out he's been slipping and sliding around AA for 2 years, and he just can't get it, and he just can't do it. And I said, well, look, would it help you if, you know, if we talked? I said, I'd be really happy to call. And this was like, I don't know, Wednesday or Thursday last week. And I said, look, and he said, well, he said, yeah, I'm not sure I like the meetings. I said, look, you don't have to like the meetings or anything. He said, if you just want to talk, I'm happy to do that. And he said, well, you know, I still have benefits. I said, look, hey, your time in AA is still your time in AA. It worked, and it's not a big deal. He said, but if you're not feeling comfortable today and we're talking about this, you want to pick up the phone? Let's talk. He says, great. We haven't talked since. Every day I get a text from why we can't talk. And so I was talking to her the other day, talking to this friend of mine the other day, and I said, you know, we are very lucky. And she was saying, you know, she was very frightened in the beginning of going back to drinking, and so she did what she was told. And I had exactly the same experience. I didn't really understand what was happening here, but I knew I didn't want to go back to that life. Yeah, I got a short sleeve shirt on, but when I first came to AA and I was in the Lenox Hill group, I had French cuffs and I wore a watch on this hand, so this left side was all frayed. And when I came in, I had to slide my shirt underneath my jacket so nobody knew what I looked like on the inside. All frayed. Now, occasionally, when I speak or I do something, I notice I'm still frayed, because I still sometimes wear a watch, and I still sometimes have a frayed cuff. But it's like, it's a wonderful thing. It's like a, you know, it's like a red badge of courage for me. That fear kept me here, because I was afraid of going back. I did not want to do that again. And by the way, for me, I never wanted to be a newcomer again. I know people love being newcomers. If anybody here is new, it's the greatest time ever. If you're a newcomer in AA, you are a rock star. Honest to God, people love you, they call you, they want to be around you. I mean, Terry is about 46 years more sober than I am. Nobody calls him. They could care less. They could care less about talking to him. But, you know, he's got a guy that he's talking to who's 2 weeks sober. His phone's ringing off the hook, you know. They love newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous. So don't waste that time.
It's fantastic. And anyway, so those are some of the things that were happening there, and I think that relationship with fear is really important. Later on, I realized that a lot of that fear was just imaginary. You know, I always say, if I don't do this, something terrible is going to happen. Well, what do you think that is? It's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, you see that in AA now. I mean, you know, you'll be shocked at this, but there are some people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and myself from time to time, who is a little controlling. Yeah. I don't mean you. No, not you. But there are others like me. They're like that. And they, don't change that. We can't do. Don't rearrange these chairs. There's five in that row. I'm going to put that one over there because there's only supposed to be four in this row. And you say, well, why do we do that? Well, if this was a cartoon, there'd be a bubble over my head and it would say, because something terrible is going to happen. Here's the deal. This is the great thing about, you know, what the old-timers taught me is that nothing terrible is going to happen. And if it does happen, nobody's going to drink. The only terrible thing for me is picking up a drink. You know, that's the only real advantage to be, because believe me, I am way more screwed up than people that just walk in the door some days. You know the advantage that I have? I've had all the firsts. I've had the first family party, I've had the first birth, I've had the first death, I've had the first everything. And so I know that no matter what happens, I do not have to drink. That's a real advantage as far as I'm concerned. You may not have that if you're a week sober, but if you don't drink today, you got a shot at having that. This is the other thing that the newcomers told me, and I didn't believe them. When I went there and Muriel was in charge of the she was about 15 or 16 years sober. She was in charge of the beginner's meeting, and she heard that I was a periodic drinker, so she found Durr to speak, because he was a periodic speaker. He was 19 years sober when I came in, which was like being 1,000 years sober. And he spoke, and we identified, he became my sponsor. Anyway, I totally lost my train of thought on there. I knew that was going to happen. I cannot remember where I was going with that because I'm getting so excited about remembering Durr. But these old timers taught me everything that I know about anything, and that was really my main point. And what they taught me was a lot of the basics. I was not smart enough to be able to read. I wasn't smart enough to be able to understand anything. I wasn't smart enough to be able to speak or, you know, understand what was going on, but they gave me the baby talk. They said, easy does it. First things first. Think. That was the stuff they gave me. It was really, really valuable. And what I just forgot to mention is what I forgot when I was talking about it is that they taught me that this one guy turned around, he said, I have no intention of quitting drinking for the rest of my life. This guy was 20 years sober. Don't give me that crap. I know you're not going to. He said, no. He said, you don't understand it. And Durr said this to me, I never forgot. He said, sometimes I think I'm closer to a drink now than I was 20 years ago. And I kind of know what he means by that. I mean, we didn't mean literally that was the case. But I think that what he was saying to me was, I get up every single day, I make a commitment not to drink that day. And then I go through. No matter what happens that day, just for today, I'm not drinking. And I don't know how you are, but I took jobs for the rest of my life. I got married for the rest of my life, more than once. I got, you know, everything I ever did for the rest of my life, I failed at. I did not succeed. But I haven't had a drink for over 35 years. That's pretty amazing. That's the only thing that I have consistently done. Okay, to a lot of people, that's not a big deal. To me, that's a big deal. And I still have that mammoth thing. You know, I'm more like Mr. Jones. I'm still a little afraid of that mammoth. And so I'm very respectful of alcohol. I'm around drinking sometimes, and I will have a drink in my house, you know, for guests and that kind of thing. And so, but I'm very respectful of it. I do not have any Jack Daniels in my house because that was my drink. I don't have any of that A-word drink that I told you about because I'm ashamed. I'm very respectful of that. They taught me that. And then I had to go somewhere. In New York, what they would do is each group would go to a meeting, and they would book speakers. So you would say, for 3 months, every Thursday night, I mean, you'd go somewhere and you'd book people to come from other groups. So you would go to London and you would book speakers to come into London, and you didn't know who it was. There was a meeting secretary in each group, and they would say, okay, we got a meeting going in Beaconsfield, and we got one in Reading, and we got one in mid-Surrey. Okay, where do you want to go? And so people would sign up and they would go off and do that. Well, that's, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing it was. Anyway, at the last minute, they sent me down to Greenwich Village. And Greenwich Village is my favorite part of New York. It's very oldie English, really, when you look about it, crooked streets and little quaint little houses, that kind of stuff. But it's also the gay capital of the world. And, of course, I am, on the inside, John Wayne. And this seemed a little foreign to me. And I walked into a room with 100 guys there. I'm like 28 or 29 years old. And I'm walking down there. At the time, I had lost a lot of weight, and I was, you know, very trim. And I'm going down, and I think, these guys are going to look at me like I'm an ice cream soda. And I'm thinking, this is horrible. I'm really frightened to go down. I went down to this meeting, and I had to speak. And I'm there in a blue suit with a yellow tie, and I'm standing up in front of them, and I just let go, and I just did my normal thing. I was about a year sober, 2 years sober. And I just was there. And people got up and they shared, you know, I took one look at you and I thought, this guy's nothing like me. I took one look at you and said, oh God, what a waste of time this is. I wish I'd gone to the other meeting. And I realized that this guy and that guy and that guy felt exactly the same about me as I did about them. And they started to share, and I realized there is no difference between me and any man in this room. There really is, except they date different people than I date. And there is no difference. And I thought, this is amazing. And somehow or other, this guy sent me down to do this. I mean, I didn't know anything about this meeting. And he sent me down to do this meeting, and I learned that I was the same as everybody else in AA at that meeting. And I thought, why do I keep thinking I'm different? What is that about? It doesn't matter where it is, I am the same. And that was a huge thing for me. And somebody, whether it was a higher power, or was this guy who sent me down there, whatever it was, but they knew that that was the time when I needed to learn that lesson. It has served me. I moved to England, and I thought I was different, and I had to remember about being at that meeting on 7th Avenue and just say to myself, you know what, they're all the same. These people are exactly the same. And oddly enough, whether they were in AA or not in AA, the people in England treated me the same way as AAs did. The people in England were so warm and kind to me here in 1985 when I moved here. My customers looked after me, and AA looked after me. The old timer said to me, no matter where you go in the world, look up a meeting, get to a meeting right away. So I did. I went to meetings around the King's Road. I got active. In those days, AA was easy. You just did what you were told. It's much more complicated now because you've got to have therapists, and you've got to have, you know, you've got to have 47 sponsors, and you have to have bring an animal to a meeting, and you know, they do it differently now. And but in those days, it was easy. You didn't drink. You went to meetings. You took a job. Everybody took a job. And at 90 days sober, you were given a job. If you were in trouble before 90 days, you didn't have a job, but somebody with a job made you help them. And that's what they did. They looked after you. If you didn't show up, they would call you. You know, if they didn't see you, there would be somebody would look after you. It was amazing. I had a lot of stuff that happened to me. After 2 years sober, my marriage And this will be shocking to you, but I came home one day and my wife said she wasn't really all that excited about being married to me. And she thought, can you imagine? I couldn't imagine it either. And so we separated, and people looked after me. I was in shock. I mean, this was not one of the great marriages of all time, and I was certainly no day at the beach to live with as a husband. And I was shocked. I was amazed. That's how aware I was. People just took me from meeting to meeting to meeting. And I've been going to a lot of meetings, so it wasn't like there. And somehow or other, I got through that. It was incredible. At 20-odd years sober, I had one of these life-altering events that people have. You know, people have a birth, a death, you know, an illness, you know, a job change, something traumatic. I had one of these at 20-odd years sober, and it was devastating for me. It was really devastating for me. And people led me around for a year. It was amazing. And I must have been a giant pain in the ass, just like I was in the beginning. But they led me around, and they looked after me. Nobody said anything. They just nodded. Guys that I sponsored were sponsoring me, because I didn't have anything. It was just one of those disorienting times in my life. And I'll always be grateful for it, because it changed the way that I walked in the world. But Alcoholics Anonymous looked after me. And that was the legacy that the people had here. I was told to get a sponsor. And when I was a year sober, I was told to find a sponsee, find someone to sponsor. I've always sponsored people. I sponsor people less now than I used to. But I always sponsored a lot of people. I always had to have a few guys under the fourth and fifth step level at a time, because somebody was there for me. I don't get how you go to your home meeting, and then everybody goes up and they go to the coffee shop, and there's some guy who just said, I'm 3 days sober, and nobody's taking him out for coffee. What the hell is that about? At my home group, I do not speak to sponsees at coffee afterwards. I do not do that. I want to make sure I'm there in case there's a new guy there. Let's do that later. Now, I'm not telling you how to do that. That's just the way that I do that. That's what they taught me. They said, these meetings are for us. These meetings are for us. We're going to stay sober by helping somebody else stay sober. So reach out, be available, do something. I was the most annoying newcomer on the planet, and I had no idea. When I meet a guy who is equally the most annoying guy on the planet, I love that guy. I think, oh, thank God I'm paying these people back. I don't even mind that the guy has just told me the same story four times, you know, like it's going to have a different outcome, you know, because I would tell them eight times. You know, this is the stuff that they did. We were very, very lucky in those days. It wasn't complicated. You didn't need to have a dog at a meeting. You know, you didn't need to have a psychiatrist to share about. You didn't need that. You didn't have to have gone to a rehab. You know, it was very simple. If you, in those days, I'm one of the few drunks around who doesn't have a drug story. I just don't. Drugs were not part of my story, and that's that. But in those days, people didn't combine the two. And so there was, now, I'll go to somebody, and they'll talk about, you know, shooting up with this gear and that gear and whatever. I don't know what that is. All I know is that when I came here, they said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. If we keep this pure and we remember the traditions, we will be around when my grandchildren may need a program. I like that. I don't care if you were shooting heroin or smoking dope or doing, I really don't care. And if you want to share about it in meetings, that's for you. For me, I keep it pure. I just want to talk about alcohol. I want to talk about that. The last thing I want to tell you about is that, and I miss this with the old timers, I don't remember the old timers going into a huge amount of detail in their speaking about a higher power. They would refer to it and that kind of thing. I'm going to tell you something. I was over 20 years sober before I had a real relationship with a higher power. My higher power lived in the meetings, and maybe before I went to bed or when I woke up in the morning, that was it. The rest of the day, I was pretty much on my own because I couldn't really trust him to sort things out. When I had this life-altering event, and I'm telling you right now, I'm on record as being somebody who is more than 20 years sober, but it took me 20 years to realize that I can use God all day long, my higher power, whether it's fate, whether it's the force, You know, whether it's, you know, whatever it is for you, it doesn't really matter. You know, you could be an atheist and have a higher power. Higher power could be gravity. You know, the fact is, I look for help all day long. I try to listen for a sign. If I have three people come up to me in a day and tell me not to do something in one form or another, I think, you know, maybe I'm not supposed to do that. I mean, I actually think about it. I like to challenge my, I am so, you have no idea how smart I am. You have no idea. You have no idea how I can see the future. I wish I could share that with you because it's so special the way my thinking is. And I have learned through people like Seal and Mansfield and people like Durr, you know, who looked after me, Walter and Gunny, who were 19 or 20 years sober, and Walter's still sober today. He's well over 50 years sober. And these guys taught me very, very quickly, challenge what you're thinking. They taught me about the traditions. And they said, yeah, but is it consistent with the traditions? In my real life, that means, is that really the way it is, Frank? Are you just making that up because that's what you want to do? I mean, I have to challenge my best thinking because every 20, 30 years I make a mistake and it's worth challenging. Did I say years or minutes? Anyway, I can't thank you enough for asking me to come along because, you know, like you were talking about earlier, and Terry and I have been talking about these old timers that were there, which I literally am not an old timer. But those old timers, they had so much to give, and I'm so grateful for them. I'm so grateful for them looking after me. Oh, I'll tell you one more old timer story. 1964, 65, I was 14, 15 years old. My father was driving himself to work and driving me to school at the same time. I went to school in Queens at that time. And we had about a half an hour ride to my school, and my father would go into Manhattan. And he brought along a guy by the name of Matty Spinner. And Matty Spinner was one of my father's favorite people. And my dad, and he was well into his 60s or 70s at that point. He had emphysema, and he was dying. And but he was, you know, still going to work, and he was in one of those periods where he was okay. But the emphysema, somehow or other, he would be talking like this, and then he would stop, and he would sleep for 3 or 4 minutes. And then he would say, and then he would just go on, he would just suddenly go right back into the sentence wherever he was. It was just a funny little thing for a 13 or 14 year old. You can imagine this was kind of weird going on. My dad let me out, and I went to school, and then that night we came back. He explained to me that Matty had this illness, and that's what he would do. But he said, you know, Matty's an amazing guy. He's an alcoholic. He got sober in Levittown, New York. In 1964, he was about 16 or 18 years sober, and Matty used to get up in the middle of the night, my father said, and go get drunks who would call him, and he'd go get them and sober them up. And I can remember, I swear to you, thinking at that time, I got to remember this. Somehow or other, I can't tell you, I never forgot Matty Spinner. So this old timer told my father, and 16 years in those days must have been a very old time. He only started in 35, so he was, you know, 15, 18 years later, he got sober. And he told my father the story of his drinking, and my father told me, Matty Spinner, 12-step me. In 1971, I was living in Cleveland, and I read about Bill W. dying. I think it was 71, 72 that he died. I remember being in Cleveland, and it turned out he was on Spillman Avenue. That was a house. I lived on Spillman Avenue during that period. He was a block away when they had the early AA meetings with Clarence Schneider, and that were there. There was a message there that Matty Spinner had carried for me. And then later on, when he said, I got this fellowship I belong to, and it's called AA, I thought of Matty Spinner. You never know who you're 12-stepping. I don't screw around with Alcoholics Anonymous. I only break my anonymity on a need-to-know basis, and when I do it, I want to make sure I'm a good representative of it. So that's how it feels to me, and Matty Spinner is the most important old-timer for me because he was my first touch of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe today somebody's talking about Jennifer's dad, Frank, who doesn't drink. I don't know. My daughter's named Jennifer. Maybe somebody's doing that. I want to make sure that I'm worthy of Maddie Spinner, because two of my children have gotten married. I've had a wonderful life. I've had ups and downs in lots of ways. It all goes back to Maddie Spinner. And Maddie Spinner went back to Bill and Bob, and so on and so forth. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for, I'm sorry, I'm not an old timer, but thanks for inviting the other old timers here, because they've got a fantastic message, and honoring them because they made it possible for me to do this. Anyway, that's it. I think I'm a little over, so thank you very much.